So, why a baby? See, I would have been tempted to write this story a bit differently. Then again, I probably want to write the whole Bible a bit differently. But I mean, what happens in the biblical story is so often counterintuitive. It's a story that regularly runs against the culture of the day. When I read the Old Testament, for example, I'm always struck how things rarely turn out as you would reasonably expect. Like, God has this consistent habit of choosing the less than ideal candidate to move the story forward. For example, Abraham and Sarah. They are chosen to parent a great nation. They will have ancestors as many as the stars. And they're in their 90s. Those are not normally considered ideal childbearing and child-rearing years, even in Qualicum Beach. And we push the envelope. But that's who God chooses. Or Moses. God selects him to lead the Hebrew people out of captivity in Egypt. But like, he's a murderer. And he's not even that familiar with the Hebrew culture. Remember, he grew up in the Egyptian palace. He actually confesses that he doesn't speak all that well. And that probably means that he doesn't actually speak the language of the people that he's supposed to be liberating. Not the first person I think of picking. Or Gideon. Gideon's a favorite of mine. Gideon is called to lead an army. And number one, he's fearful. And number two, he is, by his own admission, the runt of the litter of the weakest of all the tribes of Israel. And then God manages to make the scenario worse. He gives him an army of some 300 rather suspect soldiers who are armed with nothing but dinnerware and flashlights. And they get to take on, count them, 180,000 invaders. These are the people that God uses to advance the story. And you may have noticed that the socially expected social order, it's typically subverted. In that time and place, the eldest child was always to be the favored one. That was the expectation. And yet God so often ends up approving and elevating and using the youngest or the younger ones. Jacob, for example, is younger than Esau. There were 7 brothers ahead of him in the lineup. I'm talking about David now. Joseph's the favored one, but he had 12 brothers, most of whom were older than he was. This was a time when multiple spouses was permitted. In fact, it wasn't uncommon. And yet, in God's story, polygamy rarely ever brings benefit to those involved. It usually goes horribly wrong. Yeah, maybe that shouldn't surprise us, but that's a whole other sermon series that I've yet to preach. But we'll save that for another day. But there's lots in the biblical story that does surprise us. At least when you take a moment to look at it. Here's something else. If we were to look at the beginning of Matthew's gospel, it's the part that precedes and sets up the birth we're here to celebrate tonight. You'll see that it starts off with this great long genealogy. What Matthew does is he takes us on a tour of Jesus' family tree. He starts with Abraham and continues all the way through to Joseph and Mary and ends up with Jesus. And frankly, this is a pretty colorful group. And when I say colorful, I mean this is slightly embarrassing to the point of being kind of weird kind of group. Trust me, whatever your family lineage is like, it ain't no more controversial or strange than Jesus' family tree. I mean, they're all there. Con artists, prostitutes, murderers, adulterers, blasphemers, idolaters. These are amongst Jesus' ancestors. They are all named and they're all out there on display. And you might think that the savior of humankind might have a little more impressive lineage, but no. not what God provides.
Which, of course, brings me to the shepherds.
You have that scruffy pair who dropped by to spend some time with us this evening? I mean, what's up with that? Really? Shepherds? If there was any less respected group in all of Israel at the time, tax collectors, maybe? Shepherds were considered to be at the bottom of the social scale. And they had this well-earned reputation for being disreputable, for being lawless, thieves, general losers. Of all the people who were to be the first witnesses of the birth of Jesus, why shepherds? Why have people whose testimony would immediately be suspect? I wonder. Maybe because they had no illusions that they were more deserving than anyone else. Maybe they were pretty well aware that they needed saving. It's a strange story. Here's the birth of the one who is to be the Messiah. He's born in Bethlehem. It's a two-bit town in Judea, which is like the armpit of the Roman Empire. Dad's a pretty ordinary guy. He's a carpenter from out somewhere near Whiskey Creek, I remember. And there's the whole scandal about the birth story. You know, it looks like mom was pregnant before they got married. And that was a big deal then. I mean, that was a stoning offense then. And then there was the whole virgin birth thing. Lots of winking going on in Nazareth over that story. And Dad swallows his pride. He said something about an angel and married her anyway. And he has now managed to convince everybody in town that he's a complete doofus. The story is strange. And yet, barely a generation later, people will be declaring that this strange story, this is the way that God would choose to enter into the human history. That this Jesus was not only the Messiah, word meaning the anointed. That he wasn't only the Messiah who was going to save, but he was really divine. That he was human and he was God. And with that pedigree, with those parents, with those circumstances coming from that place, none of which you would call fit for a king. It's as if God has scripted this whole story to be the complete opposite of what we would normally expect. That God would choose to live with us in this way and to enter into the life in the same way that you and I would enter into life as a baby. It staggers the imagination. So that's what I've been thinking about this Christmas Eve. Why a baby? Defenseless, vulnerable, completely, wholly dependent on others for life and security, challenging, oh so demanding. Why a baby? I'd suggest that all these twists and turns in this plot in fact point to different elements of God's character. All of them do. But it's this last peculiarity, this coming as a baby. I believe that there's something especially powerful and important in this. Something in Jesus' raw vulnerability that tells us about the essential nature of God. Last summer we spent some time here at St. Stephen's reflecting on the issue of vulnerability. Led us into reading a little bit about from the pen of American academic Brené Brown. Her research led her to conclude that human beings live to make connections, that we are wired that way, and that connectedness gives purpose and meaning to our lives. And she even goes so far as to say, that's why we're here, to make connections. Brown's become most well known for her research into this notion of vulnerability and how being vulnerable can sometimes cause us to feel ashamed. And in fact, in one of her books, she calls her readers to own up to this really worrying reality for many of us. Actually, for all of us. That none of us are really that far from being well and truly broken. And that's true. She writes this, "We are," quotes, "those people. The truth is, we are the others. Most of us are one paycheck, one divorce, one drug-addicted kid, one mental health diagnosis, one serious illness, one sexual assault, one drinking binge, one night of unprotected sex, one affair away from being one of those people. The ones we don't trust, the ones we pity, the ones we don't let our children play with, the ones bad things happen to, the ones we don't want living next door." And she's right. Despite all our anxious attempts to tell the world otherwise, all of us have vulnerability. All of us have our places, and I'll use the word, our places of weakness. And it's hard for us to come to terms with that. We hate to admit it. In fact, we're often ashamed by it. It makes us feel a bit like a child, maybe even a bit like an infant. Dependent, exposed. That scares us. And yet, unless we are prepared to be vulnerable, we will never know and we will never truly experience love. It just can't be done. Love is an exposed, risk-filled proposition. It is never a safe thing. Which, of course, brings us back to God. In the fourth chapter of his first letter, St. John states it flatly and clearly. He writes, God is love. He does not write love as God, which is how we sometimes misinterpret that text. It's a statement that typically leads us all into all sorts of weirdness and heartbreak. No, it's God is love. That is the essential nature of God, love. And in the verse that precedes that one, John goes on to say, everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. Risk vulnerability and love, you can know God. So, you want to know and experience God? Then learn to love. For God is love. But why a baby? It's hardly what you'd expect. It seems to fly in the face of something else we believe about God. That God is powerful, right? And God is immensely powerful, incomprehensibly powerful. After all, this is the God who made the universe by simply speaking. Who created human beings out of the same elements that can be found in the dust under our feet. But God's essential predisposition is love. That's what powers God. Creation itself is a result of love. It's part of God's desire for connectedness. We sometimes slip into the belief that God's nature is one that's rather more like another figure we fondly remember at this time of the year. You know, that God's making a list, checking it twice. God's this looming, finger-wagging figure who's trying to suck the fun out of life. No, not in the slightest. God's posture is this. It's the arms wide open stance of welcome and acceptance and embrace. This God we meet in Jesus is the God who dares to be vulnerable to us, who in turn is asking us to be vulnerable to him. This is a God who loves us and so wants to be in relationship with us that he is prepared to be defenseless to us. To be at our mercy, as it were. Who's prepared to risk everything to be with us. Who God truly is shockingly revealed to us in the form of God's coming as a baby. God arrives as a baby, demanding and dependent and oh so vulnerable, seeking to be at the very heart of your life. And that baby, of course, grew into someone who was no less demanding and in many ways no less vulnerable. In fact, on the cross, in what seemed to be utter defeat and powerlessness, he allowed us to glimpse the immense love he has for us. Love so great, so amazing, that he would die for us. So we gather here this evening to ponder the strangeness of it all, and the wonder of it all. We're an odd group. We are probably no less surprising than that group of first century Judean shepherds. And perhaps for some of us, no less surprised to be here. I mean, look at you. You're in church. But you're here. We're here tonight to celebrate and to reflect in awe of the God who just loves, who dares to come to us as a baby, and who will grow into someone whose love changes everything. Thanks be to God. Amen.